Welcome to Voices of Homelessness. I'm your host, Donald Whitehead. I am the executive director of the National Coalition for the Homeless. And tonight, and for the following, I hope, very long time and into the future, we'll be bringing you live and direct people who have had the experience of homelessness in their lives. These are not your typical homeless individuals. They're not the people you see on the ads. They're not the people you see on 5-minute videos. They're people who have overcome homelessness, who are valuable members of society, and who are to be applauded for the work they do in the community and the work they do with themselves, and how they've been able to go through this very tragic and unfortunate experience, and again, be valuable members of society. It is our hope that by seeing the real live faces and voices of homeless people in our community, that it'll change your mind about solving a problem that should not exist in the richest country in the history of the world. So tonight, in our inaugural show, we first of all want to thank our team. We want to thank you, the listener, for joining us. And we hope that you'll hear tonight something that makes you want to get involved in some way by volunteering, by educating, by being a person who provides support for some of our work. And I also want to let you know that very, very soon, we're going to end homelessness. We're starting very soon a campaign to do just that. More about that later. But I want to introduce our guest tonight. Tonight, we have Mr. David Mizell. David is one of the most incredible singers, playwrights, and producers that the country has ever brought to you. David has produced plays all over the Cincinnati area. I know he's hoping to take that on the road. But at one time, David experienced homelessness, and he'll tell you about that. We also have Joel Siegel. Joel is the former legislative director for the late John Conyers, has been a part of some of the most important legislation from progressives in America. He's also a board member with the National Coalition for the Homeless. Joel, David, I want to thank you guys for being here tonight.
Thank you.
Honored to be here.
So if each of you could just tell me a little bit about, you know, what got you to the point where you needed some help, and what it was like, and what are the things that helped you get through it? If you could, talk through those things, and both of you one at a time, if you could do that. Why don't we start with you, David?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me. I'm very honored to be here. My story kind of starts off as being a participant in some drug activity, and you know, you are at a point in your life where you think you are so strong, and before I knew it, I had became a victim of crack cocaine. And from there, it was all down. A lot of praying, but I had to come to the conclusion that I needed help. My mind was out of alignment. My spirit was out of alignment. And I had to realign myself, and that's where mom and dad, they always brought me up in the church. And so as the Bible says, raise a child up in the way he should go, and when he get old, he'll come back to it. So when I got sick and tired of being sick and tired, I knew what to do, and that was to humble myself and to reach out to the Lord for help. And he did, and I'm very grateful.
And Dave, I know that you are, your voice, people would be amazed to hear your voice. We might even ask you to do a bar or two for us tonight, because I know that you're one of the best singers that really has ever been produced in the Cincinnati area. And you had a lot of success with your singing. You were attached to some really, really famous people before you went through your struggles. Tell us a little bit about that and how, you know, maybe that contributed, or did that have anything to do with kind of how things turned out?
God sends you who you need, who has what you need. And that really started with you. I remember my little apartment, they broke in, stole all my music and keyboards, and you directed me to Cincinnati Black Theater Company. And that was the start of being in theater, you know? Then one day on the bus, I met a gentleman by the name of Carlos Green, and they were looking for a lead singer. I auditioned, and they liked me, and I went on to be the lead singer of that group, which eventually became The Deal. Just kept going, but it's always been you. I know we weren't going to focus too much on you, but if I tell the truth about it, started on Reading Road and a little small vineyard where you were doing programs such as this, you know, trying to make a difference in the city. And then I started writing plays, and then I got a call one day and to be fill in with one of the for one of the OJs with the group, the OJs. From there, it's been, you know, God has just opened up doors. You know, sometimes, you know, we are the ones who are in the way. And when we sit still and let God take over, He'll open doors, unbelievable doors. Here recently, I was called out of nowhere to go to outside of Columbus to do praise and worship. It was just, and I stayed at a preacher's house. He had bought a new home with him and his wife, and it turned out to be a blessing. And it was kind of funny. They had a microphone on the floor, and it was like, "Well, David, where do you want to sing from?" You know, I'm not going to be choicy, so I said, "Well, it was on the floor," and I said, "Well, this is fine." And Donald, she blew my mind. The pastor said, "No, we want you on the stage, because this is going across the United States of America."
Wow.
So, wow. You know, it's just, you know, no matter what you're going through, you know, if you just trust God, and sometimes you have to wait. You got to wait, you know what I mean? God doesn't want us to fail, and we want things right away sometimes, you know what I mean? And sometimes, you know, although the child wants to drive, but you can't give him the keys at 9. He's not ready. Right. And I had to realize I wasn't ready. But as time went on, and setting up under great people like yourself and some very great pastors who groomed me and polished me up a little more. And I'm still in the process, but I'm going forward instead of backwards.
And I know a lot of people that might be listening might not be in Cincinnati, but if you're in Cincinnati and you hear about a Dave Mizell play, I guarantee you need to be there. This gentleman is amazingly gifted, and I can't underscore how gifted he is. We'll come back in just a second. Joel, we want to jump into your story a little bit, Joel. Joel, I've been so, you know, I had to pick like the two people that I'm inspired by. Maybe I've had, you know, some connection with them. But David and Joel, I have, these are my brothers. They're not guests on the show. They're guests tonight, but they're brothers in my life. And I wanted to, when I did this first show, I really wanted to have people hear, you know, just how far people can go. Joel, tell us a little bit about your situation.
Sure, Donald, you are my brother. I love you. And your leadership on ending homelessness is just so important. And this show is so important because often people who were formerly homeless, like myself, and I could have been homeless, you know, for a much longer time. I'll talk about that in a second. But I do want to say to Brother David, I'm a professional musician as well.
Okay.
And I'm a I am a funk bass player. I played professionally for many years. Just came out with a CD. But the fact that you're from Ohio, I'm really deep into a group called Slave. And, right. Yeah, and they were Dayton and Bootsy Collins, of course. And, you know, the Ohio players. I grew up on all that. That's one of the reasons why I became a bass player. A guy named Mark Adams who played for Slave. But my story is, Donald, I grew up middle class, went to UNC Law School, went to college there. I graduated. I moved to Washington, D.C. I got very lucky. And I got hired by the Chinese Democracy Movement right after Tiananmen Square to be their international director at age 30. Then I got hired by George McGovern, who ran for president, Senator McGovern, to be his senior legislative, you know, aide when he was no longer in office. I was born with some medical conditions that were life-threatening. One's called sleep apnea. And I had major surgery for the condition, which was life-threatening at the time. And I tried to go back to work, but my legs would not move. And I tried for 2 weeks to get on the bus, but I was incapacitated. And during that time period, I could not pay my rent and I became evicted. I came home, all my stuff was out on the street. I couldn't believe it, you know? So I called my mother. I said, Mom, I'm homeless. I had major surgery. I'm not well, I need to come home. And at that time, she was having very serious marital problems. She just said, this is not a good time to come home. And I didn't want to go home anyway. I wanted to make it in DC. So I stayed the first night. I stayed in a building, an office building, slept on a very hard cement floor with a rug. I don't know if anyone's ever tried to do that, but it's kind of hard to sleep. Then for about 8 months, I slept at different colleagues from graduate school, people from Congress. And I remember I cried every day. I couldn't believe I was going through it. That was the first time. Second time, I had to go to Atlanta, Georgia to get free medical treatment because I grew up uninsured. I was homeless there, I guess, for about 8 months. And I guess then, you know, this lasted, I think, for almost 3 years. And where I'm very blessed is I started getting my health together. I was able to get my apnea more under control. And then when I was 53, I was deemed disabled by the federal government. I'm not anymore. But at that time, I had nowhere to go. So I stayed with my sister for about a year until I got, you know, better. And it was hard for me to talk about for years because I used to cry. I don't cry anymore. I just organize. And I did run homeless shelters for many years, as you know. And I even stayed in my own shelter, which was a transitional housing and jobs program. I didn't want anybody to see me. I was disabled again. I stayed in my office, slept on the couch. And I also stayed in situations which were very dangerous. I stayed in Anacostia. I heard gunfire. But, you know, where I'm lucky is I had people who helped me out. But, you know, last 30 years, I've been working to try to end homelessness. Every day I get calls from people who are homeless in Charlotte. I try to help them get into a hotel, apartments. And I'm not going to, until it's ended, I'm going to keep organizing with you and you know, Brother David. I heard David's name, by the way, for many years. And I used to love The Deal because I play a Music Man bass, and The Deal played a Music Man Stingray, whoever played the bass. So I really love The Deal, you know. Body Talk, I believe, was the song.
Right. Yep. Absolutely right. Mm-hmm.
Joel, thank you. And I know that's hard to talk about sometimes, but it's important because people need to hear, one, kind of what happened and got you there, but that you were able to make it through. Now, what's interesting about both of your stories, and I'd love for you to talk about it, is like we have this system that we put millions of dollars into to help homeless people. But it sounds like neither one of you accessed the system or had very much connection with kind of the homeless system. You kind of made it on your own, really. You got back through your own will and with the support of God, of course. But there was no program there for you. Why didn't you guys go to like homeless shelters or other programs? And either one of you can answer that.
Well, I worked a lot of programs coming up. It was general relief. They had programs down to TAF where you learn to trade. All of these things were a result of my need at that particular time, you know what I mean? Because I had gotten to the point where I wasn't working. And of course, mama wasn't on that, you know what I mean?
Right.
A lot of times during those situations, those hard times, she was very instrumental. She would come up with these programs. I went to Stowe School. You know, I stayed there for a long time, and they had a program there. You know, like I said, you know, you can very easily, I like the way the preacher said, you know, you're out of alignment. You're the way you think. A lot of things that I was taught, I realized they were wrong, you know, and a lot of our children and people today are a victim of just bad teaching, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And people start the book, you know, and like the Bible says, it's a way that looks right to a man, but the end is death. And it's not all the time a physical death, it's a spiritual death, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
A physical death, you know what I mean? And those are the results of some of the, you know, I had to just hear someone to tell me the truth. We were talking about that the other day. You know, friends tell you what you want to hear. People who love you, they tell you what you need to hear.
Right.
And I didn't like it. Of course I didn't like it, you know. But I had to realize that I was the problem.
Right.
I needed help.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I needed help. I encourage everybody today.
And
don't take on the world by yourself. You need someone to talk to.
And do you think, like, from the people that do that for a living, like the drop-in center or the Talbert House, or some of the programs in Cincinnati, was that easily available to you? Or was the church the only place you could find your way out?
The church was my choice. Mm-hmm. You know, all of the other options were there as well. But see, I had this strong belief in God from mm-hmm. a child. You know, I was listening to your story, Joel's, you know, and this thing's about me. You know, when I was born, I'm an adopted child. See? I was an adopted child, and that was part of the testimony I told the other day. And, you know, and I said I prayed for my mother, my real mother at times, because I don't want her to think I'm mad at her or anything. And people say to me, well, how can you pray for her? And she didn't want you. She gave you away. And I tell them, it's simple, because she could have aborted me and I wouldn't be on the Zoom call tonight. Right.
Right.
So, and then I was in the hospital for 2 years as a child. You know, those are things that I don't really share a lot, but I really would, if I shared it, I would share it on your program with you. And I stayed there for 2 years. You know, I started public high school when I was 8 years old. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, I've toughed it out, and I guess, you know, I had a whole lot of reasons to give up and quit, you know, but I have just continued to press on. But those programs were available. And to tell you the truth, I thought I was too good for it. I was embarrassed to go.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I didn't want to go. I didn't want nobody, just as Joel said, he hid himself.
Right.
We don't want nobody to see us, because, you know, like the bishop says, you know, I was where I was, a sad result of all the bad choices I made. You know what right. I mean?
I think that's common. I think people don't go to a shelter or a program because, you know, pride. You don't want other people to see you there. I can identify with that. You know, you tough it out because that's a lot better than, you know, somebody seeing you there or you being there yourself is for about what you feel inside yourself too. Joel, we're going to go to you. So were programs available to you? It sounds like you did a lot of your stuff on your own also. You went to different offices and stuff like that, but you never went to, like, you know, DC has the biggest shelter in the country. CCMV has 1,300 people in it sometimes. So why not CCMV? Why did you choose to kind of, you know, go from place to place and offices? Why that instead of the system? Because I want to really help people understand, like, you know, why, you know, we don't get a real number of the people that are suffering because they don't get into the system. So the numbers that we use to talk about how many people are homeless in this country are really underestimated because there's so many people that are hidden. And they're hidden because, you know, pride is one of them, but there's so many other issues. But Joel, tell me, I don't want to guess what you're going to say, but why didn't you go to one of those programs?
The Isley brothers said it great. It's the pride. It's the pride. And I had worked for the Child Welfare League on the homeless children's march that Mitch Snyder did and Housing Now. So it was a combination of pride and fear. I was scared to go to that shelter. A lot of homeless people who I work with tell me the same thing, that they're scared of going to shelters. You know, I ran them, you know, I ran emergency shelters for a long time. And they could be scary, even if they're being administered by good people. And then, you know, be honest with you, I had what's called white privilege. I had white privilege. I had the privilege of knowing people from law school and graduate school and college that, like, for example, a lot of African-American men and women, they don't have that privilege. And so I, you know, I had privilege, and there was something in me that said, okay, this is temporary. It's not going to last that long. I was wrong because it lasted for a year. And so I stayed in basements. I stayed on couches. And, you know, eventually I called my mother. I was crying. And I just said, look, I got to come home. I can't deal with this anymore. I'm homeless for almost a year. And she said, okay, come home. And I, you know, I got to stay with my mother. So I was very, very, you know, blessed. And let's say there had been some kind of housing for people like me who had serious, you know, health issues, then, you know, I could have gone there and at least recuperated or thought through what I was going through. But that's my story. You know, You know, David's right. It was God. Every time I became homeless, three times, each time I just got lucky, you know. There could have been two different times in my life where I became physically disabled where I you know, God knows where I could have, you know, ended up. I'm just a very, very fortunate person that I had family members. And I was in Congress for 13 years. Then when I was deemed disabled, you know, before I left Congress, if my sister hadn't taken me in, I don't know what would have happened to me. I moved to Charlotte. That gave me the opportunity to go to some good doctors. They saved my life. And here I am talking to you.
I want to kind of look to what are the solutions. I mean, you talked about kind of your individual journeys, but like you see other people that are homeless. I know, Dave, you may see people. I know you do sometimes your plays at Music Hall, so you'll go past some of the people and over the Rhine. Joel, I know you do. You go into the encampments all the time.
Yes.
You know, there's a lot of programs out there that kind of lump everybody together. But both of your stories are alike, but they're very different. And so, like, what do you think would be like the kind of thing that would be most helpful? What would have been most helpful for you if you could have like stopped, you know, kind of the worst part of your homelessness before it got to the worst part? You know, who or what kind of things could have helped you through that? So if people are out there listening, we want to point towards, you know, what can help. And we could talk about, you know, the programs with the acronyms and all those things, but I really want this program to guide us in a way that I talk to real people who've had the experience, and you guys help me figure out how we end this thing once and for all. So what do you guys think about as solutions? We'll start with you, Joel. What do you think is something we could do that would really be effective?
There has to be a national grassroots movement like what Martin Luther King led in the 60s. You know, what I was one of the leaders of with John Conyers, the universal healthcare movement that passed the Affordable Care Act. We need a movement, Donald, that can get a bill passed in Congress that'll provide cities and towns with billions of dollars to build affordable housing for everybody who needs it, even if you don't have a penny. If I had that opportunity, I would have been fine. I did end up running a program like that. I'm the founder of Charlotte's first transitional housing program. And, you know, I had learned from my experience, okay, you know, I needed housing. And then in terms of jobs, you know, there needs to be like a government jobs program, like what Roosevelt did. And I actually wrote a bill called HR 1000, which would create a jobs for all program. I hope it gets reintroduced again by Frederica Wilson. Drug and alcohol treatment programs were horrible for years. I remember I would take the men from the homeless shelters and they would sit on a cement floor with a bunch of cigarettes on the floor, which is no way to treat someone with an addiction. Addiction is a disease. It's a disease. A lot of people don't understand that. You know, so people come out of jail, they don't have a place to live, they should have housing. You come out of a hospital, they should have housing. You age out of foster care, they should have housing. But the federal government is going to have to get involved in the funding of housing instead of cutting the HUD budget. So that's what I think needs to happen.
Okay. How about you, David?
I agree 100% with Joel. And a lot of things that I do now are scripturally based. The Bible says the poor will be with you always. There's no getting out of that. And some of the solutions that you guys are coming up with are very, very important. But as Marvin Gaye said, who really cares? Sometimes, you know, when people get to the point where they don't think nobody cares, you know, and especially the people who are in position to care, and they see how they seem to be more attended with helping the rich than they are with, you know, the poor. We need a lot more programs, and we need a lot more compassion. I wrote in my diary the other day, and I really mean this. I really don't like people who are not merciful. We're not merciful. I needed mercy. You know what I mean? I needed mercy, and not somebody just to cage me up or to put me in some, you know, I need somebody like you, Donald, who cares. See, you know, we know when people are pulling the wool over our eyes. We know when people are just doing it for a paycheck. You know what I mean? But what I needed was somebody who cared. You know what I mean? Not somebody to kick me when I was down. I needed somebody to help me get up. And I always said, you know, when it comes to the Lord, and I tell this in church sometime, I say, now I know many of you were saved sitting down or standing up. You know, stand up and raise your hand and but he had to get down in the mud to get me, Don. Mm-hmm. And God was the only one that was willing to go down there with me. He had to get me up out the mud, man. He got me up out the mud. And when he did that, I said, well, you know what? when you live your life by the principles of God, there are only rewards. But when you live your life by the principles of the world, there are only consequences. I believe that one of the biggest things is when they took God out of school. Those Ten Commandments are probably the most character building qualities you could ever have. So what do we expect? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Other than just total chaos. And that's why I tell stories on stage and I write songs to encourage so people can see themselves. Sometimes we don't see. We can see everybody but ourselves. You know what I mean? You know, and it's almost what Kennedy say, not what you can do for, you know, what can you do? What part can you play? You know what I mean? To help somebody, to encourage somebody. It's the process. I've learned to love it. I didn't like it. I don't like you said, me and Joel, we have two different testimonies of our journey. But guess what? I wouldn't trade it for nothing in the world. Exactly. I had to learn how to love the process.
And, you know, I think, you know, you make an important point. I think people who God has blessed with talent, you know, whatever that talent may be, and talent is in the eye of the beholder. I think there's something about that that makes you compassionate, that makes you want to give back, that makes you want to, once someone helps you, to help someone else. I know Joe, both you and Joel have done that. And Dave, I know one thing I can say about you is you always bring out the best in people. I know I have some funny stories. So me and David have done some plays together. And David is like, I know a ton of musicians, right? But David is the only musician who always gives me a chance and always believed in my singing. So I have to thank you for that. I think all three of us should get together and write a play about homelessness is what we should do.
I'm waiting.
I do think that you know, music is like so soul changing, and we need more music in our movement. We need more music to help people get to the other side. And I've always wanted to create a program that pulls out like what people have inside of them and uses that to end their homelessness. So if it's a musician, put them on stage. If it's an actor, help them get some acting gigs or some voiceovers, whatever you could do. So I'm going to count on you guys to help me do that down the road. But I do want to give you some space to just talk about like what, if you could design a program, what would be your dream program to design? So if the Department of Housing and Urban Development said, David Mizell or Joel Siegel, here's, you know, $1 billion and you can create any kind of program that you want. What kind of program would that be for you all? What I just talked about is what I would do. I believe that you look for people's assets and not about their defects. You know, whether they're substance abusers or they have mental health issues, we gotta not look at them from that window. We gotta look at them for who they are and what they bring to the table. And because there's so much talent in programs and shelters and in prison, you know, we got, I remember writing a poem about in prison, you know, Smokey Robinson was there. And Donny Hathaway was there, and Michael Jackson was there at the same time, but they all had different names.
Right.
You know, so we have so many people that have been lost to society. I do want to talk a little bit about this because one thing that I've been working on more with homelessness, I'll get back to your $1 billion program, but one thing I want to talk about is just racism and homelessness. I've been doing some work in Cincinnati, and it just blew my mind when I really dug into kind of the racial history of Cincinnati. We all know about 2000 when 15 black men got killed at the hands of the police over 5 years. But if you go back in history, it's just phenomenal how many different times there's been riots in Cincinnati, like 10 to 12. But there was also redlining that, you know, neighborhoods like Avondale and Walnut Hills were impoverished by the federal government on purpose. And it eliminated people in African-American community from being able to accumulate wealth. And I don't know, in your stories, did you talked a little bit, Joe, about white privilege and how that made it easier for you. David, have you ever, and Joe, please weigh in on this. Have you ever seen, we did a study a couple of years ago and we found out that there's 40% of the homeless population are people of color. Actually, 40% are Black people. Almost 50% are people of color. And Black people make up 13% of the population in America, but they make up 40% of the homeless population. Now, if you look at poverty, it's not related to poverty. So you have an equal amount of people, white people in poverty, but the number of people in homelessness goes down. But when it comes to Black people and Native American people, it goes up. Have you experienced any of that? Have you seen it firsthand? Was that part of your story at all? Any encounters with racism or police, over-policing?
I'm very knowledgeable, and I've experienced it to a great degree. You know what I mean? Is what I say, it's a double standard, you know? And I was raised a little different than today's generation. One of the big things with our youth and homeless, when you take the authority out of the home, you destroy a very big part of the child's future. And one of the big problems of today is problem solving. Don't know how to solve problems. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a big thing for all of us, the homeless and everybody, the youth, they don't know how to solve problems. They get a problem, go get a gun. Got a problem, go get a bottle. You know what I mean? We've got to get to the point where we will be able to teach problem solving skills. And let me say it to you like this. Your ministry is where you have victory at. See, you can't take a guy and put him in and try to talk to an alcoholic who hasn't been an alcoholic. We need to find people who are having victory, where people are having problems at. I will identify. Nobody could tell me about it. I didn't want to hear nobody. Well, Dave, you need to on page 259, this is what you need to do as far as your drug. I didn't need that. I needed to see somebody just like me winning at what I was losing at. Winning at what I was losing.
That's powerful.
You know, so if I had, and I may be jumping the gun a little bit, but if I had was able to start a program, everybody would be in my program to cover every problem in society or within that community who's had victory at what people are failing at.
So you know what? That's the kind of program I talked to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And what I want to do is a peer program that has people who've overcome homelessness reach back and help other people. So it's exactly what you said. I mean, I love the way you said that. I need to put that in the grant, that I need to see somebody have victory over what I'm struggling with. I like that. That's powerful. I need to use that. I'm going to steal it. I just want you to know right now. The next grant I write, that'll be part of it. But that's exactly what we need. We do need, because there's like hundreds of David and Joels out there, thousands, maybe millions. But the people who are still suffering, they never get to see those people. They just get to see the people that are in the same situation they are in, or people that are putting them down for being in that situation.
Right.
Because, you know, Joe talked about it a little bit, and Joe, we'll go to you because we haven't been to you in a second.
No, that's okay.
But we want to, you know, there are some really horrible conditions in shelters. And so we need to figure out a way to fix those as well. But if we could go back to the last question, Joel, do you remember the last question?
Yeah, I'm going to be John Brown, and I'm going to be honest with this podcast. One of the shelters that I ran, which was the Charlotte, North Carolina Emergency Winter Shelter, 99% Black, 120 men would line up in the freezing cold. They would be checked for weapons. They would be, you know, shown to a, it wasn't even a cot. It was a leather hammock. And I remember one of my brothers said, is this a conspiracy against Black men by white people? My answer was, yes, it is a conspiracy. Because if a white guy named President Ronald Reagan, along with a predominantly white Congress that's very wealthy, cut the housing budget from HUD by $80 billion from 81 to 85, they knew exactly what the outcome was going to be. They knew that millions of people would be homeless. They knew that. There was a Catholic priest at the time who hired me. His name was Father McCreesh. May he rest in peace. He said, Joel, the people who are in this program that you're running are incorrigible. They are alcoholics. They're drug addicts. Many of them have criminal backgrounds. They could not make it in the day shelter, you know, the uptown shelter. And my first night, I noticed the majority of men had hard hats and tools. They had come back from work. I knew he was lying. Okay. Now, 90% of the people in Charlotte who are homeless are Black. So we talk about the school to prison pipeline. We don't ever talk about the school to the homeless shelter pipeline. And I will posit that if the majority of these people were white, I do not think we would put them in homeless shelters. I just don't think there is structural racism. It is a tough conversation that we don't want to have it. I'd call it an inconvenient truth, but we must talk about the fact that homeless Black lives matter. Mm-hmm. And if, and I do get a little bit emotional, I'm so sorry, but if the majority culture is looking at Black homeless people as without souls, as subhuman, that is what I think. Mm-hmm. Then there's another segment of the white population. They're so far removed from the homeless experience. They don't know anything that about these people who are in pain. They're hurting. Many do come from poverty. And the way to get them out of their situation is, David talked about it, you've got to love them really hard. Mm-hmm. So when I founded Charlotte's Transitional Housing Program, I had the men from the winter shelter design it with me. I started a beloved community. There were some rules. I told everybody in the program, everyone here is going to get a job. You're no longer homeless. I had therapists. I had rabbis, imams, recreation. I made sure everyone had the nicest clothes, makeup for the women. And guess what? 90% success rate. 400 people put in jobs and housing in 3 years. Now, I know what works and what doesn't work. What David said originally is what works. People who are down on their luck and hurting need to feel like someone cares about them and loves them. If you don't add that love, it won't work. What do we got to do? We must end poverty. I lived in Europe for a while. There's not much poverty in Europe. We can end poverty. We don't want people to live in poverty. I really do believe that as a human, fundamental, basic human and civil right, everybody is entitled to a job, education, housing, and good food. The 1 in 5% cannot continue to run this country into the ground anymore. So America has turned into a playground for the rich. What about the 95%? Why isn't housing a right? Why isn't a job a right and childcare? and education and transportation. We're the richest country in the world. We can do it. We're going to start with this national campaign, Donald, and we need people like David to be in leadership.
I really, really appreciate both of you. You are my brothers. I'm glad you were able to be here tonight. David, I'm sorry, you know, I have to. You got to give me like 2 bars at least. I've been bragging on your voice for almost an hour. So just give me like 1 line. I don't need a whole song. But if you give me just 2 or 3 lines, because I want people to hear how deeply talented this brother is. Dave, can you just give us a couple, David?
I want to say something that'll be encouraging. A prayer for maybe the homeless or anybody that's going through. Just say, "Let your power flow." When your name is called, prove the doubters wrong. 'Cause you're still mighty and strong. So fight this battle for me. Help my unbelief. So I can tell all my friends that Donald, Joe, and David has won again.
See what I mean?
Wow.
So, so I just want people to know out there that this is a real show. It's the Voices of Homelessness. And when I tell you that there's some really, really wonderfully gifted and talented people out there who've had to deal with the struggle of homelessness, but have overcome. And I love what David said again. People need to see a victory in something they're struggling with. And you just saw a victory. If you are struggling with whatever, but you have that gift inside of you, you want to get out. You just heard it being expressed just a little bit, but just an amazing voice. Joel Siegel, amazing talent. One of the best organizers in this country, helped pass all kinds of legislation. But these are people that when someone says homeless, you don't see them. You don't see this face. You don't hear these voices. What you see is somebody who is helpless and hopeless. But the people that we have on this show are not helpless and hopeless at all. They are people who really, really can change the world. And you can help us as well. The National Coalition for the Homeless is the oldest organization working on homeless issues, and we need your support. We're starting a campaign. We need you to become a member of the coalition. You know, help us in this fight. If you don't have something that you believe and that you love about in this world, please begin to love homelessness. You see these faces. They're amazing. They're gifted. They're talented. They're compassionate. And we need you to join us in this fight. Please go to www.nationalhomeless.org. Again, very soon, very, very soon, we'll be launching a campaign, and we're hoping that you join us. Go to our website, learn a little bit more information. Please tune in again next time. We want to make sure that we end homelessness in our lifetime. We're getting old. We've been doing this for a while, and I should just speak for myself. And it's time that we
see
people that are homeless on the streets of America. And I know that these two will be fighting. I'll be fighting. We need you to fight too. Thank you for listening to the Voices of Homeless podcast. We'll come to you once a month with some amazing people. You just saw 2 very amazing people, and we promise we'll bring you more. God bless you. God bless the United States of America, and help us end homelessness once and for all. Thank you very much. I'm Donald Whitehead. I want to thank our producer, Kalita Harris from Real to Real Productions. We want to thank everybody on the staff and the board of the National Coalition for the Homeless, and we want to thank you for being here.